Good evening, anarchists everywhere, and welcome to Anarchism in the UK with me, Ian Bone. Today's guest is Ray Ruffler-Jones, a Ladbroke Grove legend, and this is Ray Ruffler-Jones with Sandpaper Blues.
Sanded down my hips and whispered, "I'm the mother of invention." Oh, you had to be tough. I was hurt and rough. I couldn't visualize what came later. She showed me the door and threw me to the floor like some worn-out piece of sandpaper. Your luck, you work all that hard. I'm out to find me a soldier. It had to be tough. I was up and running. I couldn't visualize what came later. She showed me the door and threw me to the floor like some worn-out piece of sandpaper.
Before you had a double-barreled surname, before you were Ray Ruffler Jones, when you were simply Ray Jones in Swansea. Tell us a bit about your early life in Swansea.
Well, I mean, I've been a thief all my life, basically. I never done much work. I was all right at school, but I mean, I just always attracted to the antisocial people I bumped into. And sorry, Ian. So I was just basically messing around all the time, never got anything done, and when I left school, didn't really find a proper job, and went nicking. But I mean, it's horrible, really, when you get in trouble, but it was colourful, you know.
So were you a successful thief?
Oh, hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. On a par with me mates, I was just about below standard, I'd say, yeah.
So your thieving was mainly shoplifting?
Shoplifting, anything you get your hands on, but it wasn't full-time. You know, I mean, sometimes
it wasn't a full-time career on offer.
No, sometimes, I mean, because, of course, when it went around that time, Ian, of course, it was the hippie era that started, and, when you believed in it for the little while, you could get by on next to nothing, a little bit of dope, you're in there, a little bit of speed, keep you going. You didn't need that much money with a few pints, you know.
So property was theft, but I can recall the Swansea shoplifters going into town with their empty carrier bags in the morning and then hawking huge jars of coffee and cheese and joints of beef around the pubs in the afternoon.
Well, I thought that was more it's just sexist. I thought it was the women's game. I thought, you know, people like Ken, my friend Ken, who was probably the best thief I've ever met in my life, could make fridges and cookers and all TVs disappear, all sorts disappear. And, yeah, you know, but you could always get, you know, you could do shopping on the pub. I'm sure you've witnessed that, Ian, in the Coach and Horses, etc.
There was like a shoplifting elite who could sort of cut chains and alarms and sort of work together and really, as you say, Nick's big heavy duty.
Well, I mean, some of these people, if they'd actually got a proper job, they'd have been really good, you know. You know, useful to society, because, I mean...
Wasn't it harder thieving sometimes than to get a proper job?
Oh, of course. I mean, yeah, and, you know, when you're in such a small place like that, everyone knows you. The police know you, the people in the shops know you, the people, you know, just... And it tended to sort of to take drugs or drink to go and to go about your business and all that. And, of course, that makes it, you know, you go into a shop with a big bag and you're taking six mandrakes and, you know, you're falling over all the racks and everything. I mean, you do stick out a bit, but,
That was shoplifting in Swansea, folks.
Yeah, it was.
And some of that sort of ethos of Swansea is caught in Twin Town, the film. Do you think Twin Town captures that sort of mood of sort of... the Mandrax taker and stuff in Swansea?
Well, of course, the two people, Rhys Evans and his brother Flea, played the main parts in Twin Town. And, of course, there's two... Di Roberts was the father, and two of his sons used to spend all day long... Ratty was one of the brothers. He was the older brother. But the two sons, Julian and whatever the other one's name, I can't remember, they used to play Sabutio all day, and they believed all the Sabutio players were real people. They'd have massive arguments. And they'd sit there on the bong... playing Sabutio 18 hours a day. Bong, cider and Sabutio. And of course, Paul Dunn, who was a Swansea character, you know, put him on live, like an act, a gig. And him and Kevin came up with the idea of writing a film around these two characters.
Can you, as I recall, the Tenby Hotel in Swansea was central to most things. Can you give us a sort of a snapshot of the Tenby Hotel, what it was like?
Well, of course, the Tenby was just like an ordinary boozer, and then all that sort of so-called heads got in. It was weird because, of course, a couple of years earlier, everyone's talking about fighting, darts, birds, this, that and the other, rock and roll. And then, of course, you get people sneaking in with Hess and Kafka books in their pocket and talking about Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli and people like this. You think, well, what the... Of course, they're all trying to educate themselves through the hallucinogenic drugs and the dope. And even my friend Ken, who I just told you about earlier, named his child Demian, who's a character from some Kafka novel, which I don't know how we managed to get away with that in Pentley Porth School or whatever. But, I mean.
And then along came The Alarm, the newspaper which exposed corruption in Swansea. Tell us about The Alarm.
Well, Alarm, I mean, I was selling Alarm regularly, and it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, you could not get a better antisocial, The Truth, basically, magazine for tuppence. That's all it cost, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and,
tuppence.
Everyone's, and their mother used to come and grass up their bosses, grass up the police, grass up trade union officials. It was absolutely fantastic. And, of course, I went to a couple of meetings there, and, I was young at the time, and I was full of speed, etc., and I'd want to be running around, sort of trying to, you know, cause a bit of trouble. And I was in there one day, and there was a chap there, and he was talking about money, this and really boring stuff about people's jobs, and I said, "Fuck off," excuse the language. And of course, you pointed out to me it was John Barker who was one of the Angry Brigade, so that shut me up a bit because, of course, you know, the Angry Brigade bombed the Home Secretary's house. So yeah, it was. But I loved Alarm because, I actually what's it called when you go around doors knocking doors? Canvas for the election with Alarm, you know, and we had a big vote Alarm sign hanging from. Our 8th floor flat there in Devatty Flats, and
should be recalled that Alarm was like an anti-corruption broadsheet in Swansea, which showed about 5,000 a week and was wildly popular and was full of swearing and obscenities, and it was just like a really popular paper. You and then music at the time you were doing your thieving and your Alarm and lots of other stuff. You also had a band called Devatty Flats.
Well, we call it Devatty Flats because that's where we lived, and it was easier, and you know. Had a good drink. Thing is, I was up in London and I was hiding from the police or whatever it was, and I had to go back to Swansea, and I can never forget it. I was thumbing a lift by Jersey Marine, which is at the entrance to Swansea, really, and the car drove up on the pavement. It was like an armed robber, and the poor warrant officer had a coughing fit because of this. I didn't have the guts to run away. So anyway, so I was on strict bail in Swansea. So it was around, you know, it was a good time in London. I was going to the Nashville. I was seeing the 101ers. I was seeing the the you know, the beginnings of the punk movement. And I happened to be in Swansea waiting for this court case, and a chap asked me to join this group. And, of course, I took over the group because they were a bit shyer than me. And the Vatty Flats were all right. But, of course, in Swansea, it's very much the old guard who get all the gigs. You know, it's very, very...
The Trembling Knees.
The Trembling Knees and, you know, offshoots of the Man Band and things like that. It was very difficult to play live. But we managed to, you know, cause a bit of a... stir, but nothing like you know, the next group.
And then after the Vatty Flats, who did such epics as Trouble on the North Bank of that Swansea City Football Club, then came Page Three, and you were the singer and I guess the man that made Page Three work by your vocals. I mean, tell us about Page Three.
Well, I think Page Three were absolutely phenomenal. If you know, it was your group, Ian, let's be honest. And the songs, when you think of groups now, the songs with Page Three were apt. They actually fitted the group. The girls sang about what they were doing, the boys sang about what they were doing, thieving, debauchery, political stuff, and it was absolutely fantastic. And, of course, the funniest thing I can remember about Page Three is when we were forming, we were rehearsing and we were trying to get some songs, and, you know, the people couldn't play that well. And you decided to incorporate strippers. So I thought, oh, my God, what's going to happen? Yeah, and, of course, these two strippers... two girls came into the pub one night, and they were mighty fine looking girls, you know what I mean? And one of them just sort of opened their coat and said, "Will this do?" She had nothing on, a big tattoo on, a buttocks.
I recall very well that the strippers were supposed to the strip seductively, but instead they just raced onto the stage naked and sort of rolled about on top of each other, having a great time. It was fantastic. And the crowd at the nightclub we were in, circles and so on, just poured down the front. I think 300 died in the crash.
Yeah, yeah, because no one believed that we were going to have them. But, of course, the worst thing for me was I had a stripper on either side of me singing along in my nice white tuxedo jacket, etc. And I didn't know where to look because my girlfriend was straight in front of the stage. So I didn't want to sort of cause any upset.
And then one of the songs which Page Three did was John Bindon. Do you want to tell us about the John Bindon song?
Well, I mean... A lot of your lyrics used to come out with the Sun newspaper, Page Three, hence the Sun. And Bindon was one of the ones, the story about Bindon's trick with his
I think you'll have
penis.
You'll have to spit it out, Ray. What was the story?
Well, we'll hear the song in a second, but the story was that John Bindon used to do a trick where he could wrap an amount of pint jugs around his penis and... He did this for Princess Margaret.
On the Isle of Mustique.
On the Isle of Mustique, yeah. And there's a film out there called Bank Robber, which has just been out recently. And it said that the photographs they have they were meant to have found in that bank, I haven't seen the film, were the pictures of Princess Margaret and John Bindon at it. But I don't know if that's true.
Okay, well, let's hear John Bindon.
Three pints of bitter, your favourite party trick.
Especially for John Bindon, this one.
Three pints of bitter, balanced on your prick. Three pints of bitter, it must be really thick. Three pints of bitter, it makes me bleed and sick.
John Bindon, John Bindon, all out for you. John Bindon, John Bindon, can it be really true? You're a better man than I, John B. You're a better man than me. I would like to stand next to you in the laboratory.
I mean, I'd really like to know from this and that report, how the fuck do you keep them up without any real support? How the fuck do you keep them up by the pints or halves what sort? How the fuck do you keep them up? It's more than a bleeding quart.
John Bindon, John Bindon, all I've heard of you. John Bindon, John Bindon, can it be really true? You're a better man than I, John B, a better man than me. I would like to stand next to you in the laboratory.
It must be big, it must be wide, it must be fucking long. All the reports, they can't be wrong, it must be fucking strong. I could be corrected, but when erected, large enough to bang a gong. Big enough, tough enough, huge enough, rough enough, could belong to King Kong.
Jump in there, all over to you.
Can it be really true? You're a man and I'm jumping, a better man than me. I wouldn't like to stand next to you in a
That was John Bindon. Then after that, with Page Two, then you moved up to Ladbroke Grove from Swansea, a totally different social scene. And I guess there was a sort of starts of the alternative comedy scene in the Elgin with Alexi Sale and Tony Allen.
Yeah, and Keith Allen, because, you know, we skipped a bit there, but because we got sued by the Sun, Page Three, you know, through our own devices. We managed to get the Sun to sue us and took us to the High Court. And the person who was very prominent at the trial with us was Keith Allen, of course. And Keith was a major factor on Ladbroke Grove in the Warwick Castle. We used to drink in the Warwick Castle, and Keith used to be in and out of there. And, of course, out of all those people, I mean, I don't know what he's like now. He's playing Robin Hood or something. But at the time, Keith was absolutely fearless, and his act was absolutely brilliant. And to walk on stage, not only in front of 300 people, but his own mother and father, bollock naked, to do an act. I mean, it does take a bit of bottle, I'm sorry. So I've always admired Keith. And, we used to go down the comic strip, and at the time, if you just got up on the stage, even if they gonged you off, you used to get a couple of pints. So we'd all queuing up just to go up there and say, and they go, gong off. But, yeah, Keith was...
And then through the comic strip, you had a part in Strike, the film, is that right?
Yeah, well, originally, it was the Strike was a comic strip film about the Welshman, the miners' strike. And... Peter Richardson, who directed it, wanted Paul Durden to play the Alexi Sale part, but Paul, it was a big part, and Alexi is sort of actor and everything, and Paul's, but Paul's mate's part was me, it was a very small part, but it was great because I was in it loads of different times, you know, so people could get to see me. And we went up to, where did we go? Went up the valleys somewhere, and it was unbelievable that, all his showbiz personality turned up in this dying Banwyn, it was called.
Oh, Banwyn, the miners' hunt.
And they were all sort of. I can remember Robbie Coltrane saying to talking to the barman one day about the Banwyn hunt, and I thought that the barman thought that Robbie would be anti-hunting or something. And he said, "I don't give a monkeys what you think about it. It's our hunt, and we're keeping it." That sort of thing. So, yeah, I was in the strike, and it won the Golden Rose of Montreux, but I've never worked since.
So it didn't lead on to greater things. But no. What it did lead on to was an amazing sort of time in the Warwick Castle pub in Portobello Road. There was a few years there when it was like the epicentre of social, political life. It was dead fun to be with. It's an amazing mix of people, and I think you, Ray, were actually instrumental in bringing that all together. Tell us about the Warwick Castle in the mid-80s.
Well, you know, because I come up from Wales and used to just ordinary boozers. Warwick was just an ordinary boozer, and Keith would get in there, and his brother Kevin, and all sorts from around the area. And all working class habits die hard, and we used to play pool and darts, and then all of a sudden it started becoming popular. You know, and all sorts of people used to get in there. You know, I mean, I saw Harry Dean Stanton in there one day. Rotten was in there. Elvis Costello ran out one night when a fight broke out. And I just see all sorts of people in there. And we had our cricket team, the Old Ruffians cricket team, and we were based in it. It was great. And then people used to pass by and think it was an old paddy pub and they wouldn't come in. But I think somebody must have looked through the window one day and they realised that there were loads of girls in there. And I noticed that as well. All of a sudden, it is very, very trendy. There was artists in there, writers in there, people from the film record business, all sorts in there. And of course, the reason I may have been a linchpin in there is because I was never out of there. Why? It's better than going home. And of course, I had the magazine to take care of.
Yeah, tell
us
about out of there came the Ruffler magazine. How is it called, the Ruffler, and how did it come about?
The cricket team was called the Old Ruffians, and we were based in Rough Trade, so it was just a sort of carry on from that. But the main thing about Ruffler was basically it was like a carry on from my idea of Alarm, going back to Alarm. And it was just to carry the cricket scores and a little bit of gossip about the cricket team, how useless we all were, but some of them didn't think they were, but we were all useless at playing cricket. But then, you know, take a snapshot here and a snapshot there, and before you know it, you've got Joe Strummer, you've got Keith, you've got some beautiful girl, and you've got six pages instead of two, and it went on like that, and then just built it up from there. It was quite popular, but I never sort of broke my back doing it. It took me forever to get it together, and then when I got it, I just left it behind the bar in the Warwick and waited for the jar to fill up with money
and
drank
pint.
It. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do I mean, the Warwick's totally changed. Most of those pubs in Ladbroke Grove have changed. Well, I mean, the sort of the yuppification of all those pubs around Ladbroke Grove. There was a campaign, wasn't there, for a bit against it. There was some campaign to cobblestone the entire market, and I think...
of course. They cobblestoned part of the under the bridge there where the Westway is, and it was an absolute joke. You couldn't walk on it. People were pushing prams up, and the children were bouncing up and down in the pram, and it wasn't secure. And you just can imagine later at night somebody would pick one of them up and fling it. And they got wise to that in the end. I remember one night we went down the town hall. You were there, and wasn't it? We went down the town hall. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Paul Simonon was there and all that, and they were all sort of. And we landed up in the mayoral chairs, I think, didn't we, at the back of the hall.
Yeah. Councillor Maxwell Worrell said the real opposition has arrived.
Yeah, yeah, but I don't know what happened, because they didn't seem to put up any fight, did they, the council? They just walked out.
One of them, the leading lights in the Warwick at the time was Joe Strummer, and directly out of the Warwick, we managed to talk to Strummer and organise the Rock Against the Rich tour. Strummer, amazingly, did about 25 gigs all over Britain. And you compared at least half the tour. What was that like?
Oh, I mean, it wore me down in the end. There's two reasons for this. When I was roomed up with a bloke called Darren, our Australian friend, who was, like, young, active, and we went to Manchester and, you know, we went to all these Birmingham, we went to all these towns and, you know, where there's a lot of poverty, you know. And he wanted me to go out at night, or in the daytime, sorry, knocking on people's doors and espousing the cause. And I thought, oh, no, I can't. So he went out occasionally and got beaten up. I mean, it's all I could do to keep life and limb together, because we were on about £3 a day expenses. And the hardest part of the job was beating the roadies to the rider to get a drink every night. But as you say, going back, I mean, you came into the Warwick and Joe was in there and you said, ask Joe to do it. I mean, I wouldn't ask Joe to do it, because I never thought in a million years that Joe Strummer would do that. And of course he did, he paid for it himself, and he was absolutely brilliant, I think. I mean, there's all this stuff in about him now being a saint and all that. I don't even listen to any of that, but he was a good bloke. And I'll tell you a quick story about Joe. I had a flat on Ladbroke Grove and I decided to buy it off the council. I thought it was a money-making scheme, yeah? I was on the dole, of course, but I got so far and then hit a brick wall, because you've got to pay out some money to buy an apartment. I needed £500, so I was talking to Bernie and them in the pub, and Strummer's, I knew Joe a bit, them, not very well. He said, what are you doing tomorrow morning? I said, well, I don't know. He said, meet me in here at 11 o'clock. I went in the next day, and Joe said, he wrote me out a cheque for £500 to pay the lawyer. He said, that's on the clash. I said, Joe, I'm only buying this flat to sell it so I can make a few quid. I'll pay you back. He said, no, that's on the clash. I thought, well, you know, it's a great thing for him to do, I thought. I thought Joe was good value on the road, didn't you?
Yeah, I have to say that Strummer, I asked Strummer to do a one-off gig as a benefit for Hackney Squatters, and then we upped the ante to do, would you mind doing a 25-gig nationwide tour with your band, and you pay for it all.
bring the band from America.
And bring the band over from America. And he said, yeah, all right. That was it. And the whole tour was sorted. It was amazing. But those kind of things could happen in the Warwick at the time. And, you know, I think you were totally instrumental to that, Ray. Mm-hmm. What have you been up to lately?
Well, we've got this thing called Ruffler TV. It's YouTube/ Ruffler TV. And we're trying to turn that into a TV channel, I suppose. I mean,
and what kind of stuff are you doing? What are you
filming? I mean, there's all sorts of interesting stuff. We get, you know, page three out sort of nearly back together in a funny sort of way, slowly but surely. So we do the outside broadcast of new page three songs, and we also do stuff that's going on in our local area, and we interview people. I interview John Maybe, Mick Jones, and Molly Parkin, and, you know, all sorts of people like that. But the funny one we had the other day, we went down to this bloke called John Dunbar, who was a friend of the Stones and used to be Marianne Faithfull's boyfriend. And he had a photographic exhibition, so we went to see that. And all of a sudden I said, who's this girl out here? There was a girl outside, naked from the waist down, with a dog in her lap, having her hair done and her nails done, and people reading her poetry. Now, that is on Ruffler TV. It's if you type in pubic art in a public subway, as it was a public subway, and people were just walking past, and they were amazed at this girl sort of sitting there. That was her act. That was a gig, you know, sitting there naked with people reading her poetry. Anyway, so we're looking for the obscure and the absurd if we can, but whatever we can come up with.
Oh, you did. I can't remember what the show was. You did a show. A TV programme in Ireland with Kevin Allen. I think you've been going all over Britain.
Well, that was...
And you bumped into Marianne Faithfull, since you mentioned Marianne Faithfull. And there was a bit there when I think you were in the car with Marianne Faithfull, and you think, well, I must ask her out for a drink. And you go, you must have tried it on. You thought it would have been rude not to. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and I didn't know, I thought I'm going to carry this through to the end, I'm going to get knocked down here. But so on the way back, come out to this pub, we're going to go. I sang. I remember it was karaoke or a band. And I sang there, and I went on the way out. I thought, right, I'm going to try my luck by now. I'm not going to get anywhere, but I'm going to try my best. So I get into the car, and as we get to the car, somebody smashed the windows and robbed all the contents of the car, which was a bit of a libido sort of sinker, that one. So that was the end of that. But the funny thing that was, when we went to Marianne Faithfull's house that day to pick her up, the person who was with us said, he knew you were in the other day, He knew you were. He was in. He was knocking. He was looking in all the windows. He knew you were here. And I thought, what are they talking about? And Marianne said, I couldn't face Van today. It was Van Morrison knocking on the door. So if Van hasn't got a chance, what chance do they have? So that was. Kevin made a documentary about the 19 something World Rugby World Cup, and we went all over the country again on a shoestring, again on about £4 a day expenses.
One of the latest lyrics you've written is about Damien Hirst. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
If there's anybody out there now, this is a Page 3 exclusive here. Our Christmas song is called Any Chance of a Sub, and it's directed at Damien Hirst because he seems the type of bloke who would help us out. We need a few bits and pieces to get the band off the ground. And I've been trying a few people, to help me.
Go on, read it out.
Yes. And it basically goes like, any chance of a sub? Any chance of a squeeze? Oh, let me start again. Any chance of a sub? Any chance of a bung? I can't remember it. Yes, I can. Everyone will tell you we suffer for our art. But as for raising revenue, we never make a start. We wrap carrots up in popolin and ran them up the donkey's arse. We ran them by Jay Joplin. He said, I think I'll pass. So is there any chance of a sub? Any chance of a loan? We feel about as useful as Dali's telephone. Any chance of a bung? Any chance of a squeeze? Reciprocate and we finish off that Modigliani freeze. Thank you, Damien.
Bloody hell, that was tops. Okay, thanks, Ray. We're gonna go out the programme with a hitherto unheard.
Well, this is Joe Strummer, one of my favourite songs. He sang this for us in the Warwick one night. He was his Indian one night, Joe. I said, do a few songs. And he said, yeah. And this is one of the ones he'd done, is Ride a Donkey.